1 John chapter 2, verse 15. Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For everything in the world, the cravings of sinful man, the lust of his eyes, and the boasting of what he has and does, comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires pass away, but the man who does the will of God lives forever.
The environment in which I grew up was filled with smoke. Not that I could have told you it was, because I didn't realize it was. I mean, if you asked me if my parents smoked, I would have said yes, but I didn't really think about it. I didn't really notice it. I didn't really smell it. I didn't really see it. I didn't taste it. It was just there. It's the environment I grew up in. It was all I'd ever known. And then later, when my older sister began to smoke as well, there were three of them and me, and they all smoked. And we get in a car in the wintertime, you know, windows were all rolled up of necessity because it's cold. And I never even noticed, really. It was just there my whole life. And then I go off to college, you know, eventually at 18 or so. And I get to college and was in a different environment. And I would go home for the weekend. I still didn't really notice anything was different. It didn't faze me to go back into that environment. Except that when I would come back from college, I remember one time somebody said, "Where have you been?" I said, "What?" And they go, "You smell like smoke." I go, "Oh, yeah, I guess maybe I do." But I didn't notice. And for years it went like that. And of course there were longer and longer spans of time when I was not at home with my parents. And longer and longer spans of time where I was away from that in a different environment. And so it took years and years and years before I went into that environment again. And all of a sudden went, my eyes started burning. And I started realizing, wow, it's pretty heavy in here. Yeah, I'm thankful to say they've all since, by God's grace, been able to leave that behind. But I share that to tell you that we all grow up in that environment. We all continue to exist in that environment. Not with smoke, but in another environment that is just as pervasive, just as all-consuming, just as unnoticed, unseen, detected by our noses, as that was to me. And that environment into which every one of us is born and continues to exist to this day is called the world. The world. That's what John is referring to here in chapter 2, verse 15, when he says, do not love the world or anything in the world. It's one of the three primary battlefronts that we wrestle against as Christians. The world, the flesh, and the devil. And we began a series of studies last week, which were something calling Winning Life's Battles, Overcoming the World of Flesh and the Devil. And we said that there's three primary battle fronts along which all of our struggles and battles of life confront us. And we kind of looked in an overview way last week. Today we're going to begin to look now for this Sunday and a couple more, the battlefront of the world. What is this thing, the world, this atmosphere into which we're immersed from our earliest moments? What is the essence of the world? Well, really, in the Bible, the phrase the world has three basic broad strokes kinds of meanings. One is the physical creation. It's the pew you're sitting on, the stuff we can touch and taste and feel and see. It's there, it's physical. The Bible says in Acts chapter 17, verse 24, God made the world and all the things in it. Physical creation. Another way the Bible uses the term the world is to describe human beings, the human race. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son. That means he loved petunias and peacocks, but that he loved people. It's the human race. But there's another way that the word or the term the world is used, and that's what we're thinking of here. It's more of a moral meaning in the moral realm of things. And that's the way John uses it here in chapter 2. And that's the way we're thinking of it now. And let me throw out this definition and you see what you think of it. When we talk about the world in that sense, we're talking about the fallen creation headed by Satan and organized in opposition to God. The fallen creation, headed by Satan and organized in opposition to God. Now, that raises some questions right away. Somebody's sitting here somewhere saying, really? Headed by Satan. You're saying that. This is exactly what I'm saying. Three times the night Jesus was betrayed, he referred to the devil when speaking to his disciples and called him the prince of this world. The prince of this world. In chapter 5 of 1 John, in verse 19, it says, the whole world is under the control of the evil one. Ephesians 2 says, as for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins in which you used to live when you followed the ways of this world and of the ruler of the kingdom of the air, the spirit who is now at work in those who are disobedient. Yes, it is headed by Satan. That's true. Somebody else is sitting here and saying, now really, you're serious. An organized system? Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Well, I should say that's exactly what the Bible is saying. The word behind our English word world is cosmos. In its most rudimentary form, it means something that is well ordered and well arranged. It describes that which is systematized. It is that which stands in opposition to chaos. You remember those words from the second verse of the Bible. It says the earth was formless and empty and darkness was over the surface of the deep. It was describing a chaotic condition that God had put things in to begin with. And then he began to speak his word, and out of the chaos, he formed cosmos, an ordered world. But later, the evil one seduced Adam and Eve into sin, and through Adam, the head of the race and the vice regent of creation, he plunged all of creation into rebellion against God. And we might be tempted to say, well, you know, there was chaos and God created cosmos and then Satan came by and he recreated chaos. But that's not quite exactly the way it is. There was chaos. God created cosmos to the glory of his name. As we've been singing already today, the physical creation speaks to the glory of God. Well, Satan lusted after that glory and wanted it for himself. And so when he seduced Adam and Eve into sin and plunged all of creation into rebellion against God, it's not that he created chaos, it's that he created another cosmos, another world system. In opposition to God, a world in which the glory goes not to God, but to Satan. An ordered system of things where it's not his glory that is promoted, but that of the evil one. It says in Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. It's an ordered system headed by the evil one, systematized and worked out in many ways through his evil spirits as he administrates this opposing cosmos. Now, if you were with us last week, you remember that the evil one's primary tactics are falsehood and fear. Falsehood and fear. He leads, I think, most of the time with falsehood, lies, deception, and he's perfectly content to keep us there. He's perfectly content to let us go on going to church and working our jobs and all of those things, as long as he can get us to own in, to hook us a little bit with some of those lies and just keep us off kilter and to cause our service and testimony for Christ to be marred and not as full of glory to him, as to God, as he wants it to be. So, knowing that his primary tactic is falsehood, we need to be aware that the marketing department for Satan's lies, his deceptions, is called the world. The marketing department for the deceptions of the evil one is called the world in the Bible, in this sense of the word. The slick four-color trifold brochures for Satan's deceptions are thought up, put together, peddled by an advertising agency known as the world system. It's what John refers to here. And he seeks to employ a saturation salesmanship technique. That is to say, he wants these thoughts to be so pervasive, so dominant in all of our understanding and our thinking and the messages that are sent to us, that they become second nature, they become unexamined, and we never stop to even think about them at all. We never see them. We don't breathe these in any recognizable fashion. When you smack your lips, you don't necessarily say, there's the world. But at some point, by God's grace, by His Spirit illuminating hearts through the Word of God, we go, oh my word, I never noticed that before. See, the advertising department of the evil one, the world, is not selling merchandise. It's selling ideas. And not just individual ideas, but a whole way of thinking. It's marketing, hawking to us, not just individual thoughts, but getting us to adopt and developing within us a certain kind of mind by which we think. That is to say that not only do we need to think about the essence of the world, as we've been doing now, but we need to think secondly about the message of the world. What is the message of the world? Now, remember, from what we noticed last week, and we just put the chart up there again, we are made up of body, soul, and spirit as human beings. Body, soul, and spirit. We said that the world primarily addresses us at the level of soul. Well, flesh addresses us at the level of appetites or our body, and the evil one addresses us primarily at the level of our spirit. The world confronts us at the level of our soul, which is made up of mind, emotions, and will. And it begins with the mind. The world hawks and sells a certain way of thinking to us. And it does so because it knows that tethered behind our thinking are our emotions. But the emotions aren't even the ultimate thing. But you have to go through the thoughts to get to the emotions, and through the emotions to get to the will, the choice making. And so the world sells us this message. It sells us these ideas. It sells us this way of contemplating things and making decisions and assessing and saying things. And there's a synergy at work, as we noted before, that it's not just the world, but it's the world, the flesh, and the devil all in cahoots together. But we take it apart to consider the world because it's so pervasive. Now, there's three basic messages the world sends. The evil one attempts to introduce into the atmosphere these three ideas so thoroughly, so all-pervasively, that one, we never notice objectively or recognize their voice, that they're there. And two, that they go unquestioned concerning their legitimacy. And interestingly, these same three messages of the world were the tactics the evil one used when he tempted Eve in the garden and when he tempted Jesus in the wilderness. He describes them for us here in verse 16. For everything in the world, you want to subsume it all, the whole message of the world, everything in the world is this: the cravings of sinful man, the lust of his eyes, and the boasting of what he has and does. Let me put those in a singular word for each one. I think it might help us think about it more clearly. The simple message of the world is more, mine, and me. You ever heard that anywhere? More! Mine, me. That's the message of the world. Now let's go back and think about each one of those individually. More. He calls it here the cravings of the sinful man, or as other translations might say, the lust of the flesh. That sinful part of us that gives way. And lust, we might run in our minds and think, well, that's referring to sexual deviance. And it includes that. But it's more, the idea of lust, it might be communicated with the word desire or craving. It's an appetite out of control, over the top, out of bounds, over the banks, and flooding everything with its demand to be fed. Now, the appetites were created by God. They're good. Appetites were His gift to us. He tells us to address those appetites in appropriate ways. But the message of the world is that those appetites need to be fed more. That they go beyond simply appetites to demands, to obligations, to a lust for more. It's the appetites, in a self-centered, self-indulgent way, fed independently of God and His design. It is the desire to enjoy. That's what it is. to enjoy. You say, wait a minute, doesn't the Bible say God's given us all things richly to enjoy? It does. And it's true. He wants us to enjoy all things, but He wants us to enjoy them in relationship to Him. With Him. In communion with Him. Within the boundaries that He's put down. It's hedonism, really. Just the sheer pursuit of pleasure. Now, we have several appetites. God-given appetite. We have an appetite for food, for drink, for sleep, for sex. But out of bounds, over the banks, running over, dominating and flooding everything, the appetites for food and drink are known as gluttony. The appetite out of bounds, over the banks, flooding everything, out of control, all-consuming in the realm of sleep is laziness or sloth. And out of bounds, over the banks, running over, dominating everything, the appetite, the message of more in terms of the appetite for sexual relations is immorality. Fornication, adultery, every form of sexual deviance. It's food for food's sake. It's sleep as avoidance, sleep for sleep's sake. It's recreation for recreation's sake alone. It's sex just as a raw physical pleasure-seeking event. And the devil used that before. For Eve, it says in Genesis 3:6 that when the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food, God had said, you can eat any tree, fruit of any one of these trees, just don't eat this one. And she looked at that. The serpent led her to look at this one, the one God said you can't have. Look at that one. And she saw it was good for food. It would address her appetites in a particular way. Jesus was in the wilderness. He'd fasted for 40 days. The tempter came to him and said, if you're the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread. Jesus answered, it's written, man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes from the mouth of God. Really, what the world sells us is a sensual approach to life. And by that, I mean not just sexual. I mean living life to gratify your senses. It is a glandular approach to decision making. It feels right. And right feels wrong. You know, it's the old song, if it feels so right, how can it be so wrong? Or something like that. In fact, I Googled that, looking for the title of that, and I found there's all kinds of songs about that. Not just the one I was thinking of. Every genre of music has got at least one song about something like, if it's so wrong, how can it feel so right? More. I thought of the man who once stopped by my office and just wanted to stop by, chat with his pastor and inform his pastor, hey, I'm leaving my wife and kids. I got another woman. Just wanted you to know. Oh, well, thanks for stopping by. Oh, and by the way, I've already talked to three other pastors in town. By the way, not this town. But I've talked to three other pastors in town, and they all, when I told them my story, I told them the kind of thing, they said, well, you know, you've got to be happy. Really. More. Second line of the world is mine. The lust of the eyes. It's the desire to have. Enjoying it's not enough. Just to enjoy it's not enough. I have to own it. It has to be mine. I have to have it. It's materialism. The devil used it with Eve. It says, when the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was not only good for food, but it was pleasing to the eye, something in her said, I want that for me. I want to make that mine. Jesus, the second temptation, the evil one took him to the top of the temple and said, throw yourself down from the temple. After all, the scriptures say that the angels are going to lift you up and won't allow you to strike your foot against the stone. Do us a great, big, glorious, eye-popping miracle! Where everybody says, I want that kind of God! Jesus said, it's written, don't put the Lord your God to the test. It's a covetous approach to life. As I read, somebody said the other day, it's buying things I do not want to impress people I do not like. It's what I think Dr. Richard Swenson describes as the dominant theme of our culture now, is more and more, faster and faster. Third truth or line that the world tries to sell to us is me. It is the boasting of what he has and does, or the boastful pride of life, as one translation puts it. It is the desire to be. To enjoy and to have is not enough. I want to be something spectacular. It's egoism, as Robertson McQuilkin calls it. And the devil used it with Eve. It says, when the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was not just good for food, not just desirable for the eyes, but it was desirable for gaining wisdom. That is to say, you know, if I eat this, I'm going to know right and wrong, and I won't need God. I can kind of call my own shots. I can say, you know what, you say that's wrong, I say that's right. It'll be about me. Jesus, third temptation, says the evil one showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. And he said, you can have all of this if you will just bow down and worship me. You know what? You'll have every kingdom of the world will be yours. You'll only have to be subject to me. You'll be second in glory, second in power. Wouldn't you want that? And you don't have to have the cross that way. Jesus said, away from me, Satan, it's written, worship the Lord your God and serve him only. It's really a self-centered approach to life. It's pride, it's arrogance, it's hubris. Self-absorption. Me. I remember several years ago, I can't remember how long, but one night I flipped on the TV, 5 minutes, I think it was the Country Music Association Awards or something like that. And it just happened, they were announcing, I think, Song of the Year or something at that time. And so this big award, and everybody, they announced the winner, I won't say his name, but he announced it, and big guy comes up, and he gets the award, and he kind of comes up. As I recall, first words out of his mouth, I just think it's really great, I got Jesus in my life. And I thought, hey, that's kind of interesting. And then it dawned on me, the song that was playing, the song that had just won, and how it's reverberating through, and the title of the song is, I Want to Talk About Me. Chorus says, I want to talk about me, want to talk about I, want to talk about number one. Oh, me, my mind. What I think, what I like, what I know, what I want to see, want to talk about me. Not going there. No. I think I just violated that third line. Made you think about me. But that's what it, I mean, we're just wired that way. So there it is. More mine and me. Now, where do we meet that in our world? Where's that come to us? Where is the great jet stream of that line of thinking pouring into our environment, our world, our culture? Where's that pouring into us constantly? It's the media. Music, the arts. Print media, whether you're talking about books or magazines or advertisements or whatever, TV, DVD, internet, film, iPods, cell phones, all the stuff we put on those, load up on that, all that. Everywhere we're hearing the screaming message, more mine, me. And we don't even know it most of the time. Now, I contemplated at this point thinking, well, wouldn't it be interesting if I could just come in and I could say, well, here's something I pulled out of the Sunday paper today. Look at this advertisement. Doesn't that say more mine or me? Or you know, here's a video clip of a movie that said, or here's a bit of a song or what, you know, and then I realized I could do that for weeks. It's everywhere. More mine and me. So here's what I want to do. I want to give you a little assignment. You can be research assistants. I want you to go out this week, and I want you just to go the course. Don't go out of your way to do something or whatever. But I just want you to just go the course, and everywhere you meet more mine or me, I want you to recognize it. Might be a song, might be a commercial, might be a TV show, it might be a DVD, it might be a song on your iPod, it might be, who knows, whatever, it could be. But wherever you are being sold the idea of more, mine, or me, I want you to take note of it. And if you can get to a computer and think of it, I want you to email jkitchen@stowalliance.org and tell me what it was. You know, you don't, if you forget, that's all right. I'm not going to share them all, everything, but just say, let's take assessment. Just say, I was driving, I saw this billboard. Somebody stopped me this morning and said, I saw this commercial, and it was my name. That's exactly it. He said, that was it. It was more mine than me. Now, before I move on, I want to address something, because I'm just got the feeling there's some sitting here right now, and they're getting uncomfortable, and you're slipping out one of the cards from up your sleeve, and you're about ready to play the L card. Because this is getting too close to some things for you. And in your discomfort, you're just about ready to play the legalism card. Bah, that's legalism. You know, and that's what we do in evangelical Christian circles when application hits too close to home. Ah, legalism! And that's the signal for the pastor to go, I'm so sorry. And walk and go home. Because, oh my goodness, not legalism. Now, I'm hoping next week that maybe we can go into some more of this and help us wrestle with some of the implications of all this, and how we wrestle with this and how do we apply this. But I'm going to suggest to you that it is at least going to mean these two things. Discern and disconnect. Now, we cannot disconnect from everything in the world. Jesus said, I'm not asking you to remove them from the world. I'm leaving them in the world. We're on a mission here. We are in the world. We're not supposed to be of the world. So we can't entirely disconnect. I mean, we could go, you know, sit on the top of a pole in the northwest corner of North Dakota where no one's around, and the world would find a way to get its message to us. You cannot disconnect entirely from the message of the world, these things. But we can always be discerning, and then we selectively need to disconnect. There's some things we just ought not watch, ought not see, ought not listen to, ought not think. But how do we do that without really falling into a legalistic mindset? Well, hopefully next week we can talk about some of that. But for now, I want you to move with me from the essence of the world, the message of the world, to the ways of the world. How is it that the world does battle with us? How is it engages us in the struggle? Well, it's not like you might think. When you hear the term battle or war or fighting, you have certain images come to mind. That's not the way the world fights. The world draws us into a battle of affections. That's why John says here in verse 5, do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. It's a battle of affections. The world wars by wooing us. Not by attacking us. It's a battle of competing loves. John's quite categorical, is he not? He says you cannot love the world and love God at the same time. The one dispels the other just like light dispels darkness. And water filling an empty bottle displaces the air. So love for the world displaces love for God, and love for God displaces love for the world. That's why James chapter 4, verse 4, he says, you adulterous people. And he's not referring to people who've run out and physically gotten involved with the neighbor's spouse. He says, you adulterous people, don't you know that friendship with the world is hatred toward God? Anyone who chooses to be a friend of the world becomes an enemy of God. Look back, if you will, to the left in your Bibles a bit, to 2 Timothy chapter 3. Paul describes there the atmosphere of the last days in which we live. Here's what will pervade the atmosphere of the last days, he says. And I want you to notice how often in his description the idea of love comes up. Chapter 3, verse 1 of 2 Timothy. But mark this, There will be terrible times in the last days. People will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boastful, proud, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, without love, unforgiving, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not lovers of the good, treacherous, rash, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Paul says the world of the last days will not be a loveless world. It will be a world filled with love, but not toward God. It'll be a world of misplaced love. A world at enmity, at war with God. But it never addresses us on those terms. It does not battle against us. It seduces us. It woos us. It flirts with us. It flatters us. It allures us. It beguiles us. It's attractive. It looks fun. It looks like it's fulfilling. It seems logical. Now, to close this morning, I want to take all of this out of the realm of proposition and principle, and I want to set it before us in a person. We relate better to persons, so let me do that. A person named Demas, a person with a life and a story, just like you have a life and you have a story, and I have a life and I have a story. Demas had a story. He was a Christ follower, a person who traveled in ministry with the Apostle Paul himself, evangelizing, ministering side by side with the great apostle. He's mentioned several places in Scripture. Colossians 4:14, Paul sends greetings to the Christ followers in Colossae from Demas, his partner in ministry. Philemon 24, Paul calls Demas one of my fellow workers. He's a man who had at some point heard the gospel of Jesus Christ, realized his need as a guilty sinner before a holy God. He repented and believed in Jesus as his Savior. He grew and matured in the things of God. He got involved in ministry. He began to see that God was blessing his ministry. People recognized the gifts from ministry God had given him, the effectiveness that he had in ministry. And so he was invited to travel with the Apostle Paul on his missionary journeys. Amazing thing. But here in 2 Timothy, the last of Paul's letters, just before Paul is going to die, he writes in chapter 4 and verse 10, and he says of Demas to Timothy, "Demas, because he loved this world, has deserted me." Demas, because he loved this world, has deserted me and gone to Thessalonica. He has loved this world. He has loved. In technical terms, it's an ingressive aorist, meaning it didn't just happen all at once. It happened over time. He didn't just make one great giant leap into the world. He was seduced away from Christ and into love with the world. That's the way it always happens. The way it always happens in this world, or at least usually happens this way. It's not just somebody wakes up and says, "You know what? I think I'll destroy my life, ruin my family, lose my job, and go hook up with another person." You know, people don't do that very often. It's a conversation that's had. It sparks a little something inside, a little look back and forth, a little flirting, little, you know, joke here. Oh, you know, and your hearts are, next thing you notice each other, you spend a little time, and slowly, your heart is drawn away. That's the way it is spiritually. That's why one writer is absolutely right when he says, before Demas deserted, he drifted. And that's how the world works. In fact, there's an obvious contrast right here. Verse 10 talks about how he loved the world. In verse 8, the same participle is used when it talks about, Paul says, "Now there is in store for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but all who have loved," or it says here, "long for," it's literally "have loved his appearing." Same term. Demas had once been a Christ follower. He'd been in love with Christ. He longed for the day Jesus would come back. But slowly, his love was leached away by the allurements of the world, and he found himself now so in love with the world that he deserted Paul in his great need. He drifted. And C.J. Mahaney is absolutely right when he says today the greatest challenge facing American evangelicals is not persecution from the world, but seduction by the world. It's absolutely right. Our brothers and sisters in Christ around the world, many of them, their great struggle is with persecution from the world. That is not our problem. Not now, not here. Our great struggle is the seduction of the world. So how do we win in a battle of competing loves? Well, I think we need what Thomas Chalmers, the Puritan, put as the title for his message on this passage in 1 John 2. It's called the expulsive power of a new affection. Now, that's a big term. It's not explosive. It's expulsive of a new love. The expulsive power of a new affection, a new love. That when a new love comes and grips your heart, it expels all other loves. That's exactly what John's saying. And the way you battle against the allurements and the flirtatious nature of the world is not by saying to yourself, I will not love the world, I will not love the world, I will not love the world. No, it's not me, it's not mine, it's not more. Because what do you do when you do that? All you're thinking about is not the world. No, I'm not going to love that. And all you're doing is loving the world because you're filling all of your time and thoughts with the world. It's just a backward way of bowing down at the altar of this world system. You don't win by saying, I will not love, I will not love, I will not. You win by falling in love with Christ again. Just coming back and say, Jesus, somewhere along the line, I don't know how it happened, I don't know when it happened, but somewhere along the line I went over here and I have not loved you. I have loved the world, and I ask you to forgive me. And I come back and I'm saying, Jesus, fill me with your thoughts, fill me with your truth, fill me with the wonder of your love for me again. Jesus, woo my heart to you again. It's like Thomas Chalmers said in his message, we know of no other way by which to keep the love of the world out of our heart than to keep our hearts in the love of God. So I ask you as we conclude the message, who you love? Do you need to come back to Jesus and just say, Jesus, I'm sorry. I've lost my first love, but I want it back. Fill my mind, fill my heart with the truth of who you are, the wonder of God's grace, the magnitude of your mercies to me. Take me back to the cross again, Jesus, and show me what that means. Show me again who I was, who I am before you, what you did there for me. Show me what it cost you. Show me again why you did it. Show me again your love for me and fill me up so that I love you again. I want you to bow your heads and close your eyes.